So over the course of Saturday and Sunday, we're going to talk much more extensively and explore the nature of what is called the three pillars of the path, that sila, or ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. So I'll talk a lot about meditation and different styles of meditation in the course of the weekend, and we'll get to practice a whole bunch of different things. For tonight, since the topic is loving kindness, my favorite topic, I'll just start by continuing on a bit from what I was speaking about earlier, that there's a whole way of viewing meditation practice, and there are many styles of meditation practice that are devoted to helping us see more clearly what our experience actually is. Because it is said that out of that clear seeing emerges wisdom, emerges transformation. So we're not trying to make something change. We're trying to be with things more as they actually are. And that intimacy with what is true, that recognition of what is more true than maybe our more normal projection and delusion and confusion, will give us what we want. It will be born out of that kind of clear seeing. And so those are practices like mindfulness meditation that will say over and over again, we're not trying to make anything happen. We're not trying to make anything go away. We're trying to have a clearer relationship with what is arising, whether that's painful or pleasant or beautiful or kind of awful, whatever it might be, or anywhere in between. It's all okay. Because the work is to change our relationship with everything, and out of that changed relationship, we can understand it. We can understand ourselves and understand our lives. And it makes sense, right? Like if some emotion arises and as soon as it comes up, we hate it and we fear it and we're struggling against it and we're trying to make it go away. There's not going to be an awful lot of learning that goes on because all our energy is going into that battle. And we're not willing to kind of look and take more of an interest in what our experience is. So we work with being more mindful, trying to change our relationship, not for the sake of passivity or giving in or not caring at all. Although I know the words can be confusing. It can kind of sound that way sometimes. But instead, it's not about passivity. It's actually about right relationship so that we can uncover layers of insight and understanding. So what happens when our experience is felt by us to be quite pleasant, wonderful, welcome? Maybe we're in this very balanced, open relationship with that experience, or maybe not. Sometimes we have this kind of wonderful thing happen, this great feeling or great experience, and right away we cling to it. How am I going to keep it? How am I going to keep control over it? How am I going to keep it from ever changing? So we're actually not even enjoying it anymore because we're so frozen, trying to keep it from ever changing, which of course is an exercise in futility anyway. Right? So that's not a very wholesome or skillful relationship. Sometimes this really pleasant, wonderful thing happens and we're so distracted we hardly even notice it. We can be so fixated on what we don't have rather than on what we do have that we might have very little appreciation, very little gratitude. So that's not a very enjoyable or full-on experience either of the pleasure. Sometimes this really wondrous, beautiful thing happens and we're almost embarrassed, like we didn't deserve it. And so we kind of want to tuck it away or avoid it a little bit. these days I have a story about that, where last December I went to Maui to teach with my friends Ram Dass and Krishna Dass. And of course I'm from the East Coast, right? So that's like a nice break from a ghastly winter. And Maui itself is just gorgeous. It's like this unearthly paradise. It's so absolutely beautiful. And the retreat was held in a resort. We like took over this resort, and the resort is right on the beach, and so like the dining room's right on the beach, and there are no windows, so it's all like the ocean is right out the, you know, it's like a few feet away, and it's just this amazing, amazingly beautiful, pleasurable place. And I was, of course, it was an actual retreat, which people were doing, so it was on my schedule, but something, I don't know if I put it on Twitter or Foursquare, something happened, so which was all my fault. So I put out some kind of message and said, I'm in Maui. So I started getting all these responses, like, wow, you're on Maui, how incredible. And I found myself responding by saying, it's very humid here. It's awfully humid. You wouldn't like it all that much, you know? And I thought, ooh, look at that. That's weird. But we can do that, right? And that became kind of a thing at the retreat because I mentioned it in a talk, and then I was walking out of the meditation hall one day, and these two friends of mine were walking behind me. One was a woman, and the other was the now adult son of another woman. And the son was saying to our other friend, wow, my mother really regrets not having come on this retreat. She was so close, and she really wanted to come. And then at the last minute, she decided she just couldn't. And so my other friend said, did you tell her how humid it is here? She's really not missing anything, you know? So when we talk about mindfulness, it doesn't mean we don't experience the joy or the pleasure of something. It means we can actually experience it in a better way and also learn, because we can pay attention to all these different layers and dimensions of what we're feeling. And certainly with painful experience, we can be really conditioned to be so ashamed and so fretful and so frightened and so resentful and so many things we might add on to what's already a difficult, hurting kind of place. We then add, who knows what, projection into the future. What's it going to feel like in 20 minutes? What's it going to feel like in 20 days? What, you know, and just like, and we pile on all of that anticipated difficulty or pain or this feeling of isolation rather than connection to others. And if it's someone else's pain we're witnessing, then maybe the tendency to want to isolate them so as not to feel disrupted in some fashion. And so many things that are kind of strange ways of relating to pain rather than compassion and openness and honesty and togetherness, things like that. And certainly with neutrality, all those places that are not very painful, not very pleasant, they're just kind of in between, where our conditioning is very much to kind of take a nap, you know, go to sleep, wait for something more exciting to come along, more thrilling to come along, so we can feel alive with that. We can really be basically addicted to a kind of intensity rather than feel connected with an ordinary, routine, repetitive experience. So the whole range of mindfulness practices are designed to help us be with pleasure, be with pain, be with neutrality in a different way. So not only do we have a better day, because we absolutely do, but we have the profound possibility of insight, wisdom, learning, understanding, which will be born out of that changed relationship. So there are all kinds of meditation practices that are basically designed not that they exclude other things, but the emphasis is very much on that kind of clear seeing. There are other meditation practices that, again, don't exclude mindfulness by any means or clear seeing, but they're almost, it's like they emphasize what I now call a stretch. It's realizing that maybe our perspective is sort of narrow or habituated. The way we look at something, the way we look at ourselves, the way we look at others, something is kind of constrained. We're in a rut, in other words. And we have the intention to step out of that rut and look at life from a different angle. It's not an untrue angle. It's not like we're falsifying things or getting sentimental or phony about anything. But it's realizing, okay, I'm so used to looking at things this way. What's it going to be like if I just look at things from that way? And it's not that I enter the land of delusion, but actually it becomes a more true picture because it's more inclusive. So the example I commonly use is what I hear very often from psychologists and researchers is a practice that is quite healing and transforming, and that is to keep a gratitude journal. That means at the end of the day, write down three things that you feel grateful for from that day. And I always say, and one of them can be that you're breathing. You know, it doesn't have to be grandiose or amazing. Now, honestly, for me to do that is a stretch. I have personal conditioning, I have cultural conditioning, where the most natural feeling thing at the end of the day is to write down what I can complain about. Right? Well, I mean, really, this flight was great, but last trip I took, you know, why couldn't they transfer my luggage to the earlier flight when there was that 3-hour delay? I mean, really, that's the kind of thing that I would more be habituated to recount. You know, this person was disappointing and that thing was late, and why not this, and, you know. And it's just conditioning, right? So I was teaching somewhere a while ago, and somebody in the kind of team was trying to teach us jokes. So this is a joke. It may be a little New York-centric. I'm not sure. You can tell me, actually. The joke was that there's a group of women sitting at a table in a restaurant, and the waiter comes up to them and says, "Is anything all right?" In contrast to, "Is everything all right?" Right? So that makes a lot of sense in New York. So that's what I mean by conditioning. And sometimes we realize that, and it's not in an angry way or a condemning way, but it's really the sense of an experiment. It's like being creative. I want to step out of the bounds of this constriction and just see what it's like when I remember, you know what? It wasn't all bad today. There are things to be grateful for. It's good to remember we're breathing. Right? So it actually makes our life fuller, more complete. It's a more true picture than just being lost in the constraints of those habits. So loving kindness meditation as a methodology is very much like that. It's not, it's aligned with mindfulness practice. It's very connected by and supported by mindfulness practice. But as a method, it's really like that stretch. If, for example, at the end of the day, you are in the habit of pretty well going over your day and sort of evaluating yourself, like, how did I do today? And if you are in the habit of just remembering the things you did wrong and what you said not so skillfully and that time you were too timid to say anything at all, let's just say. So much so that your whole sense of who you are and all that you will ever be collapses around that really stupid thing you said at lunch at the meeting. So the stretch of mindfulness, the experiment of loving kindness, is almost like asking yourself, did anything else happen today? Like anything good? It's not deluded and it's not phony and it's not make-believe because you're not insisting, oh, wasn't that a brilliant and witty thing I said at lunch at the meeting? Maybe it was really stupid. And there are consequences for that. But that's not all that we are, ever. So it's that collapse, that limitation, that excessive identification with what's wrong. That's what we're challenging. So loving kindness practice works like that. We stretch. You think about all the many beings we may encounter that we look right through. We don't acknowledge, we don't notice even fully. One of the very simple and I think very beautiful teachings of the Buddha is when he said, all beings want to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. What would it be like to go into a grocery store, go into a dry cleaner, encounter a whole lot of strangers or people that maybe you see fairly often, but not in a way where you really notice them much. They serve some kind of function in your life. What would it be like to go into that store and reflect, this person wants to be happy, just like I do? And a further elaboration of that is the recognition that if it's true we all want to be happy, then that urge is a very beautiful thing. It's not something we should feel squeamish about or uneasy about. Because when that urge toward happiness is aligned with wisdom instead of ignorance, it can be like a homing instinct for freedom. We can cut through many obstacles. When it is aligned with ignorance, we continue to make the same kinds of mistakes that we make over and over that are so hurtful and so painful. But that's a kind of interesting experiment. Encountering people and thinking, maybe this person wants to be happy, just like I want to be happy. What does that change in your day? It's quite interesting. So this all has to do with the perspective of loving kindness. The word loving kindness is the common translation, as many of you know, of course, from this word in the Pali language, the language of the original Buddhist text. The word is metta, M-E-T-T-A. If you've ever been to the retreat center I co-founded or seen our literature, which I'm sure is here somewhere because it follows me around wherever I go, it's a large brick building with white pillars and it has this word up above, metta. When we first bought the place in 1976, we moved in. It was a novitiate, a Catholic novitiate. It was run by the Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament. And that's what it said up above the doorway, Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament. So we asked somebody on this very cold day to get up on this very tall ladder and said to him, see if you can play around with those letters and come up with something that means something about us. Like what we represent, what we want to represent in the world. So he got up on the ladder and he came up with metta, M-E-T-T-A. And what then followed were these incredible discussions. Because remember, this was a pretty pioneering effort. We were the first group establishing a center that didn't have like a complete tie to a particular Asian teacher. And we were very connected to many teachers in different lineages, all within the same sort of basic tradition, but we were very conscious of the fact we were in the West. It wasn't like an exact replica, for example, of a Burmese center. And so we had to discuss everything. We had this big discussion. The way we phrased it, it's very funny saying this here. Should we have Buddhas in public places? Because very much the spirit that I encountered in India, that we all encountered in Asia, was this has nothing to do with Buddhism, really. As my first teacher would say, the Buddha did not teach Buddhism, the Buddha taught a way of life. And everything he is said to have discovered as a human being, we can discover through the power of our own awareness. So we look at a Buddha statue, we're really looking at ourselves, or the capacity of the human heart for boundless love and compassion, for incredible wisdom, and so on. So we said, well, should we even have Buddhas? Because you don't have to have Buddhas, you know. I mean, it's respectful and it can be wonderful and aesthetically extraordinary and tremendously inspiring, but it's not about Buddhism, it's about ourselves. So here we are in the West, maybe we shouldn't have Buddhas, and you know, what should we do? And one day this U-Haul arrived and it was all these Buddhas that turned out when Jack Kornfield was in Thailand, he was an amazing shopper and he bought all these Buddhas and they were sitting in his mother's attic in Maryland somewhere, and then they just arrived. So we said, okay, let's put them out. So we had Buddhas, in case any of you thought it was a very studied decision, you know. And then there was metta, and we thought, what should we do? You know, it's not an English word. No one knows what it means. Why have a word up on top of the building, which no one's going to know what it means? We're not in India anymore, or Thailand. We're in America. Why not have an English word? But it's such a beautiful word, and it's such an important word. And so we went back and forth and back and forth, and the point of view that wanted the word to stay up there prevailed, which I was very happy about, because that was my point of view. And I just like it. I like the fact when somebody calls for directions, we say it's a large brick building with white pillars and it's got this word up above, metta. And then they usually say, well, what does that mean? And we say that means love, or that means loving kindness. It is, I think, as probably all of these words, and certainly many of them are, it's kind of difficult to translate completely. The usual translation is loving kindness, and that's fine. My concern, as many of you have heard me talk about, is that because we don't use the term loving kindness in casual conversation, it might make the quality itself seem somewhat arcane and removed from day-to-day life. Some scholars actually have told me they prefer the word love as a translation. But that can be extraordinarily complex for us because we certainly use that word in a lot of different ways to mean a lot of different things. And sometimes it really is, frankly, a medium of exchange. Like, I will love you as long as you love me in return. I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. You know, so many things that are very different from that sense of metta, and what we might mean by metta. I've also talked about how often I had hoped that the word metta, M-E-T-T-A, itself would enter the culture, and then we'd feel our way into the nuance and the subtlety of everything that it is meant to convey. My most recent hope was when Ron Artest, who has been an L.A. Laker, changed his name to Metta World Peace, M-E-T-T-A, World Peace. And there was, in fact, a brief flurry of media interest when he changed his name, and then that died down. And then I guess last season he had some problems and he behaved rather badly on the court maybe, and so all my friends were sending me these newspaper headlines that said things like Metta's gone bad, or world peace fails again, you know. And that didn't work. But he just signed on to the New York Knicks. So I started getting all these rather puzzling emails from people saying, we've got to go to a Knicks game. And I thought, I don't know. I've never been to a basketball game, but okay, you want to take me to a basketball game, I'll go to a basketball game. And then another one, and then another one. I said, what is going on? You know, and then I found out that, hey, he's going to be in New York, so maybe we'll meet someday. It's like really great. But in the absence of that word entering the culture, we're left with loving kindness or love. Sometimes the literal translation of metta is friendship. And so it means developing the art of friendship toward ourselves and toward all of life. It's a very, very subtle state. It is not easy to understand except through experience, because we have so many associations. If I, you know, talked earlier about the idea of mindfulness sometimes being associated with passivity and not caring and not doing anything about anything, then certainly loving kindness or love can have all kinds of associations, you know, like not being strong, not being clear, not having good boundaries, only saying yes, giving away everything you have, taking care of others and not having any compassion for yourself. Burning out, just giving and giving and giving in terms of one's energy or service or caring without any sense of balance. There's so many ways that we can have different kinds of impressions or associations with a state like loving kindness. So I really always think it's kind of the almost like rigorous experience of it that will bring the clarity, even if we don't ever find the words to express the clarity. We know inside the distinction between loving kindness and foolishness or lack of discernment. We know the need to balance loving kindness for ourselves and loving kindness for others. We know the very intricate state of having compassion and caring for someone and the wisdom to recognize we're not in charge. We're not in control of their decisions, of the outcome of an action, of help, or whatever it might be. These are very profound states that we may not figure out intellectually. We may not even be able to describe. But we come to a different understanding inside through the experience. The experience is born of that stretch, being willing to take some risks with how we pay attention and who we pay attention to, and the quality of our meeting ourselves and others. So I think it's an extremely interesting avenue to explore. It's quite creative to realize that we are so habituated in so many ways, and that we have the capacity to step out, to step away from the particular way we're used to seeing or doing things. So here's another example. Just as we might do that reflection that all beings want to be happy, There's in fact a prior reflection that's sometimes done as a springboard for loving kindness. And when that prior reflection is just quite unrealistic or unavailable, inaccessible to us for some reason, then we move on to, well, all beings want to be happy. So the prior reflection is looking for the good in others. So, as you know, as I've said, when I went to India to first learn meditation, then I came back, and then I went to Burma in 1985 to do intensive structured loving kindness meditation, which I'd had done loving kindness meditation, but never in that kind of dedicated way, you know, to really dive into it. So I had that chance in 1985 when I went to Burma for 3 months, and very quickly my teacher brought up that earlier reflection. He said, I want you to go back to your room and think of different people that you have different feelings for, and see if you can think of one good thing about them. So my first thought was, I don't want to do that. I thought, that's what stupid people do. They go around looking for the good in everybody, and I don't even like people who do that. I'm not going to do that. But as I tell the story, I was very far from home. I was in a Burmese monastery. And it's a very traditional culture, and the nature of the teacher-student relationship in a very traditional culture like that is not one where the teacher suggests you do something and you say, show me why I have to, you know? It's like, not like that. You do it. So I did it, and it was so interesting. My fear, of course, was that I was going to end up just all sentimental and stupid and not being able to see the edges and the conflict and the pain, which was also true. And that's not what happened. All of that stuff was still clear to me, but I found if I could think of one good thing about somebody, that includes ourselves, there was just a different sense of connection. Rather than this huge sense of gulf or separation, there was some sense of connection out of which I could look at or reflect on even what might need to be done on my part, to the extent I could do anything to try to shift some of what was really wrong or negative. So I even thought of somebody who I found quite tremendously obnoxious, I think in a perfectly reasonable way. I think he was really obnoxious. And I had a memory of having been present when he did this incredibly kind thing for a mutual, like, acquaintance of ours. And he did this generous, kind act in the most beautiful way, so that she didn't feel pitied or condescended to or put down in any way. He just did it so well. And I was there when he did it. So he did it right in front of my eyes. So that memory came up in my mind, and then I thought, I don't want to think about that. That complicates things. I liked it better when he was all bad all the time, you know. It's simpler, but life is very complicated. Feelings are complicated. Caring is complicated. We're complicated. That's why the perspective of loving kindness isn't moving to something that's untrue. It's moving to something that's more true. So whether or not you do a formal loving kindness meditation, I think these are wonderful exercises to bring into one's life. If you're talking to somebody, notice how present or absent you are. Are you really listening? Are you really looking at them? Or are you thinking about the 15 emails you need to send? Or what time your flight is on Monday? Right? And if you find you are very distracted, see if you can gather your attention and actually just be there. If you find yourself going through the litany of someone's faults, again, a very familiar list, ask yourself, if you can do this in the right spirit, is there anything good about them? And that does indeed include yourself, if you're having that kind of day. Again, it's not to deny all the rest, but just to stretch, let's see. And if that doesn't work, if it feels forced, totally forced, contrived, uninteresting, then remember that other reflection. All beings want to be happy. We actually really do want the same thing. And we get so confused and so lost sometimes. But everybody actually wants to be happy. Think about that when you meet a stranger, when you're recollecting somebody, when you're thinking about yourself. Think about what you might have to be grateful for at the end of the day, just as an experiment. See what happens when your mind isn't only going to what is going wrong, which needs to be admitted and confronted for sure. But see what happens when you also include that which is supporting us or holding us together or leading us onward or whatever it might be. So in that way, our whole life, life itself, becomes like this creative medium, and it's all like an experiment in loving kindness. Okay, so we're going to take some time for some questions. We don't have a microphone for you, so I'm going to need you to really try to speak loudly, and I'll have the fan shut off if we need that, okay? If you have any questions or comments, anything you'd like to say or ask. And if you don't, we'll do a loving kindness meditation. But if you do, yes, please. Okay, so the comment was that she's had this suspicion on occasion that she moves to doing loving kindness meditation in order to avoid some of the work that she actually should be doing, which might be, I'll add this, kind of painful or difficult in insight meditation or doing mindfulness practice, which in Pali is known as Vipassana. So is there any way to avoid that? I mean, this is because loving kindness is my big thing, you know? Like, I wouldn't worry that much about it. And this is like a little intricate, but there is this teaching in Buddhist teaching, which is not so commonly talked about, but it's a little bit like what I've just been saying. It's like the stretch. And it's called gladdening the mind. That there are a lot of things that are talked about because they lift our spirits, and we're encouraged to do them to gladden the mind, so that when we then confront suffering, it's from a better place. It's like with more resourcefulness or more resiliency. Because the idea isn't to sit and suffer and feel overcome and overwhelmed by the suffering. I mean, sometimes it's very intense. That's true. But the whole idea is to have a different relationship to it than what we're used to. And that's not so easy. You know, a lot of times people think, and I actually thought this in my earlier practice too, the idea was more to suffer and then break through the suffering and get through to the other side, rather than seeing the process more as changing my relationship to the suffering. So there was a kind of pressure there. But if you think about gladdening the mind, then it's like building resiliency skills or building resourcefulness, so that those times when we are looking directly at something that might be quite hard to be with, we're doing it from a better place. And that's all good. It's not a cop-out. It's not avoiding. So a lot of things the Buddha taught, we'll probably go into this more tomorrow and the next day as well, those of you who are here, are about gladdening the mind. So generosity. They say that anytime the Buddha spoke to lay people who were not monastics, monks or nuns, he always started by talking about generosity, because generosity brings us joy. And if we actually practice generosity, we will access greater joy. So, and as the Buddha put it, everybody has something to give. It doesn't have to be, fantastic. It doesn't even have to be material. paying attention to that person who strikes up a conversation with you, smiling, thanking somebody, you know, like everybody has something to give. And the best kind of generosity is said to come from a sense of inner abundance. Because if we feel we have nothing and we are deficient and bereft, we're not going to have that sense of having anything to give. So just as the best kind of generosity comes from inner abundance, it also kind of gives us a glimpse of that sense of inner abundance every time we respond to somebody with kindness, or we actually materially give something, even if it's very small. It reunites us with that sense inside, and that lifts our spirits, which is a good thing. And ethics, morality, which we'll certainly talk about more over the weekend, is all based on that. That if we have a crazy life that's deceitful, we have a lot of secrets, it's all kind of duplicitous, it's not impossible to sit down and meditate and have a great tranquility and peace pervade one's being, but it's going to be a whole lot harder. Because it's like we're setting the stage for complexity and turbulence and torment and guilt and all kinds of things which will come up when we sit down to meditate. So it's almost like a plea from the Buddha. I mean, he didn't put it this way, of course, but it's almost like for once in our lives we can do something the easiest way possible instead of the hardest way possible. So the hardest way possible is to have a really messed up, complicated life and then try to meditate. The easiest way possible is to gladden one's mind by having kind of cleaner, clearer relationships and, you know, less guilt and remorse and turbulence going on. So that gladdens the mind. Loving kindness gladdens the mind. When instead of being so lost in fear or a sense of being so alone and cut off from everybody, and we actually feel the quality of connection, which is at the heart of loving kindness, is connection, it will really lift us up. You know, so the path is very graduated in that sense, as described, because it all gives us the kind of resource we actually want to have. We want to have building so that we can be with anything. So I say go for it. Yeah. Ooh, I can't hear you at all. Okay, so feeling someone else's pain and isolating them to, okay. So feeling someone else's pain, but then isolating them so as to save ourselves from the sense of disruption of a more kind of placid, easygoing feeling. So I think there are different elements to that. One is, I think that is very strongly a cultural conditioning here in sort of the larger American culture. In that it's not very easy to accept or open to suffering or pain or difference or anything like that, because there's such an incredible premium on control. And I think that when we ourselves are in pain, there's often this tendency to add on the sense of, oh, I should have been able to stop this. You know, why am I going through this? And that includes not only kind of frank pain or emotional pain, but even getting older, getting sick, or sometimes even dying is seen as kind of personal humiliation. Like you should have, you know, somehow avoided this. And I think it's kind of part of the ethic of sort of the mainstream culture. And so it takes a lot for any one of us to open to, with compassion, our own pain. And just as that's true, because of that sense that pain is aberrant, it's wrong. It's a sign of loss of control when someone else is clearly having a hard time in any way. We are taught to kind of tuck them away somewhere, right? Sometimes literally, often literally, so that we don't have to have that disruption to our own kind of ordinary oblivious day. And so we think we have that kind of conditioning going on pretty strongly. And there's also the understanding that this is something I'm very interested in. It's a little hard to describe, but I mean, in research now, sometimes they talk about it as the distinction between empathy and compassion. Empathy being a really necessary but not sufficient component of compassion. So empathy is clearly essential to have some kind of resonance with someone else's situation. It's almost like a vibrational sense. Not that we know exactly what someone's going through, because I don't think we do, but we have this felt sense, almost like, oh, I remember a time when I felt abandoned, or I felt unseen, or I was lied to, and I remember how awful that felt. So I'm witnessing you in some situation, and there's this kind of sensibility like, ooh, that likely really hurts. You know, so without the empathy, we're just cold. You know, we're just removed. So the empathy is really essential, but I think, and this is my own formulation, but it's one way of seeing it, I think we can have that kind of empathy, but then we might respond in a whole variety of different ways. And, you know, one classic way is what's called empathic distress, where we get kind of overwhelmed in that situation, and our own distress, ironically, actually takes center stage. It's more pronounced than our awareness of the other person's situation. At that point, we feel really bad. We feel really crummy. We feel, you know, whatever it might be. Or as I sometimes put it, we might see somebody's pain, sense it, and feel frightened by it and want to run away. Or we might sense someone's pain and blame them for it. Like I told you last year how to live, you know, to be a lot happier, and here you are, you know. You didn't follow my perfectly good advice, and so of course you're suffering. I mean, really. Or we might feel or sense, you know, the pain someone is likely in and feel just crushed. We're exhausted. You know, we're depleted. We don't feel we have the wherewithal at all to approach them. To see if we might be of help. Or we might have that strange kind of control thing that sometimes happens, like, I got it, I'm going to fix it, I'm going to fix you by probably Tuesday, let's say, maybe Wednesday, you know. And or we might have a compassionate response, which is more like, I mean, classically, in Theravada Buddhism, in the southern schools of Buddhism like Burma, they call compassion the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. So it's almost like a movement toward to see if we can be of help, but without that insistence that we will be of help. So it's without the exhaustion, without the blaming, without the fear. So it's a particular kind of response to that felt sense. And so one of the there are lots of ways of framing it. One is that compassion can be trained. Other people will say, well, you can't train compassion, but you can train the precursors to compassion so that compassion will emerge. I mean, I don't really care which way it's said, but the idea is that something can be trained so that being able to respond to someone's pain in a better way can be trained. And I think that's very true. It's something that in the West is considered kind of wild or radical. Like, what do you mean you can train it? You know, like, and I don't know why it's so surprising, or it's like a pronouncement, like, wow, it can be trained. Maybe it feels too cold, you know, or mechanistic, or sometimes I think, well, maybe we think that compassion is like a gift, and you either have it or you don't, and if you don't have it, you're out of luck, or it's just a kind of spontaneous emotional reaction in the moment. There's nothing you can do, but clearly there are things we can do. And I don't know how many of you saw, someone's going to help me with specifics here, that article in the New York Times. Somebody wrote an op-ed piece. It was a scientist at Northeastern University where he did this experiment, and this won't be precise because I don't have it in front of me, but he did, I think it was an 8-week meditation class with people, and then he put people in this completely staged, phony environment where they were sitting in a waiting room someplace, some of the people from the meditation class and some other people, and there were a limited number of chairs in the waiting room. And then he had somebody, like an actor, come in who looked like he was in terrible pain, you know, crutches and some look on their face, you know, so they were wincing and looked like they were in terrible pain. So the question was, who got up and offered a chair and who did not? So apparently the meditators did very, very well in that, which I'm extremely gratified at reading. You know, so clearly, I mean, we don't actually need that experiment, although it's nice to have it, but clearly it can be trained, that particular response. And but it has to begin with being able to feel the empathy without falling into the empathic distress. You know, having some amount of balance there in that relationship. Okay. We're going to close with some more announcements.